Hello and welcome to Monocle on Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today we're discussing Tate Modern's new survey show on Steve McQueen, the British artist whose work mostly lives in the world of moving image and film, although the ways in which these films are set up is often sculptural. There is always message in the medium with McQueen. This new exhibition mostly looks at works from after 1999, the year he won the Turner Prize, till today, and so features, in a way, McQueen's second phase. Where he used to feature in his filmic works, he now holds the camera or directs the action. But whose is the gaze and who is the viewer? The idea of looking is key to McQueen's uncompromising work. The viewer is a voyeur. During moments of intimacy, things can feel dangerous, transgressive, inviting, and the opposite. It's tough stuff, full of texture, depth, and ripe for interpretation. Is it beautiful? Need it be? Joining me in the studio today to discuss Steve McQueen are Louisa Buck, who is contemporary art correspondent for the Art newspaper and columnist for the Telegraph Luxury, and Ben Luke, art critic for the Evening Standard and reviews editor at the Art newspaper. And listeners might also be familiar with both of their voices as the Dream Team on the Art newspaper podcast. Lovely to have you both here.
Lovely to be here.
Welcome to the programme.
Thank you for having us.
Ben, welcome to your maiden voyage on HMS Monocle Culture Show. We'll be gentle with you. The seas are calm here. It's like a mill pond in the studio, isn't it?
It is.
It's all right in here.
Serene.
Until we start discussing Steve McQueen.
Precisely.
The transgression. The body. So in your Evening Standard review, Ben, you talked a lot about the physicality of the camera work of McQueen's work, but also its focus very much on the physical, on the body. Talk us through some of your points on McQueen and the body.
Well, I think what really struck me as I was in the show was just how sharply focused it was on the body in all sorts of ways. And, you know, the body does so much in the show. You have the very tight close-up of McQueen playing with his nipple, tweaking, pulling, pushing. And then you have another film where a body falls from the sky endlessly in this serene sea of white, but it actually relates to this horrific incident from the 17th century in Grenada, where McQueen's family is from. And so you have all sorts of bodies presented in enormously different ways, but there is this constant focus, and one can never, ever forget the physicality of the body in the works, but also, as you say, the camera and McQueen's directing. It's such a physical process and such a palpable energy in that work towards, which is focusing around the body. Yeah.
And we start off in that first room with a kind of, I suppose, a body of sorts, one of the most famous in the world, that of the Statue of Liberty. We fly around it like the aeroplane in King Kong, Louisa. There's something corporeal about that. It makes that famous piece of sculpture seem vulnerable almost.
Well, you get incredibly up close and personal, I think, with McQueen's work, and you certainly do with the Statue of Liberty. You see that she's got a bird's nest in her armpit, her robes are grungy and dirty, but there she is, this iconic figure. And Ben's so right. I mean, it is so bodily, because even with this one, which is about another body, you experience it with your body, because the helicopter goes round and round. I think McQueen said he wanted to be like a mosquito, sort of buzzing around the Statue of Liberty, and it judders up and down this helicopter. You have the sound of it, and you experience it with your body. The whole background, the panorama of Jersey and all the sort of land behind and around the Statue of Liberty swirls around, and there's this static figure in the
center. You get vertigo from watching him.
You get vertigo, as you do, and you feel very peculiar watching him very close up, filmed through an old-fashioned projector, pulling away at his nipple and tweaking it and caressing it, and it's absolutely cropped up close. Or indeed another one just adjacent to this piece, which is his finger caressing this very famous hooded eye, that of Charlotte Rampling, with the red background. And all you see is his finger pulling and prodding under the hooded thing, and he actually touches her eyeball at one point. And there's all kinds of references to Buñuel and Chandelou and all that, but all you can do is blink and sort of your own eyes water at the thought. And throughout this show, there are these bodily feelings. I mean, you know, whether he's sending you plummeting 3 miles below the surface to experience the horrific life of a South African gold miner in the deepest mine in the world, in an epic, extraordinary film of Dante-esque sort of horror, or indeed, as Ben said, the floating figure, or you're in a booth with Tricky as he goes into a kind of shamanistic trance, but you're there, you're close, you're up to the nape of his neck. So you feel this with your body while you're watching their bodies.
And it's often, the way you've described it is beautiful, Louisa. You feel that you feel uncomfortable. There is a sense of voyeurism in a lot of these films. I mean, let's talk about that Tricky one. I know we're going to talk about Tricky a little bit specifically later on, but what's it like being in that? It's not a small room. There must be 70 people you could fit into that particular viewing booth in Tate Modern, Ben. But it feels like you're watching. It feels like you're in the recording booth with him. What's that like? How does McQueen get this sense of uncomfortable intimacy?
Well, I think that you feel like the camera must be right under Tricky's nose. You know, yeah. It's so tightly cropped. And there he is. And, you know, the performance is almost violently intense. You know, he's clutching the microphone as he's delivering. It's the song Girls, which is actually on an album called Blowback, which actually featured the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And it was like actually not that great a song in its final form. But in this form, it's so primordial. Yeah. It's kind of so intense. And McQueen's ability to capture that performance, it's that sort of, as you mentioned earlier, in a sort of almost shamanistic kind of intensity. Tricky is almost possessed, but also the camera seems possessed. It's so tightly cropped around Tricky's head and the process of delivery of this vocal that you are channeled into that physical experience. You know, and again, you know, so you feel like you are almost inhabiting that body. You
know? But he's cleverly not sensationalist, is he? I mean, the camera stays very... his croppings and his shots... I read somewhere that when he shoots the film, I think he shot 12 Years a Slave in something like 3.5 weeks. You know, it was extraordinary. So every shot... because I think he said when he was early on, he used Super 8 film and it was expensive, so he had to consider every shot. So he doesn't flash his camera around. There's not lots of clever angles. I mean, he does change the camera. So with Tricky, the camera is pretty static, and it's usually the subject that imbues it with the intensity. So the camera sort of stays there like some witness. Of course, it's not. It's highly subjective, and McQueen is brilliant at framing it. But you sort of feel like it's Tricky infusing it, not McQueen. You're not really aware of McQueen. You're just totally aware of the uberness of Tricky. And then suddenly, you know, he goes into this intense several takes of the song. There are incredible lyrics all about, you know, absent fathers and daughters, and so there's a whole kind of subtext to that. But then he'll suddenly, you know, he goes into almost like a trance, eyes rolling, and then he'll stop, and he's kind of rather broad West Country accent. Go, yeah, I'll do a retake now.
Yeah. You know, so, yeah. Are we getting the vibe?
Are we getting the vibe? Yeah, exactly. So you know, there's a really good kind of puncturing of that. So it doesn't go into too much sort of hocus-pocus hagiography. He's always really objective. It really is about looking.
So let's discuss it. That's an interesting point, and I think it runs through a lot of these works. How heavy is the hand of the artist here? There is great intent in everything that Steve McQueen does, but you don't get a sense... Well, I don't know. You can tell me, Luke. I don't get a sense of clever. I don't get a heavy hand of the I don't sense a heavy hand of the artist on it.
I think this is a really interesting point, because I think he's super specific in terms of what he wants from what he does. He sets up each individual shot with such precision, and yet you're right, there's a sort of element of light touchness. But let's look at that Western Deep film In the Gold Mine. Mm. I think this is a classic example of the formality, the intense formality of Steve McQueen's work, in that he said he wanted to shoot it on Super 8 film. And the reason that he wanted to shoot it on Super 8 film was because he wanted specifically to access the graininess that is the physical experience that those people have in the mine, the graininess of stone, the graininess of being a miner. Now, when we see it, it's, yes, it might be shot on Super 8, but it's not on a projector. It's projected onto the size of a wall. It's deeply grainy, isn't it? It's almost...
It's lost even more focus. And, yeah, yeah.
But also, the film itself, it's almost like the film can't really take in what's going on. So it's almost like the film kind of dematerialises. It goes, as Ben's quite right, it goes into sort of geological texture. So as you plummet beneath the ground and experience this appalling, you know, activity...
And it's 80 degrees Celsius down there.
It's 80 degrees Celsius. Yeah. There's also, he's brilliant with sound. So sometimes it's silent, and then suddenly this deafening, cacophonous noise of the drills that they're using, and just this sheer experience of, you know, you just get an inkling, a vague inkling, but boy, a vague one's quite enough for me, about what these guys experience on a daily level. But the film itself kind of dematerializes, because it's not high resolution. It just sort of melts and goes rather painterly and strange, and then kind of materializes back, and you see, my God, that is an outline of a person drilling away, and then it'll bang into light, and you'll see these guys doing some horrible exercise to sort of decompress them after being so deep. You know, it's never polemical. I mean, that's another thing about him. You know, it gives the experience of this appalling mine, which, you know, is just basically these guys are suffering deeply for, you know, Western and every civilization's greed for gold. You know, nobody needs gold, but there it is. But his work is often political in the broadest sense, but it's never political in a specific sense. He's never polemical, and it makes it so much richer. I mean, one could say Static, that we talked about earlier, the Statue of Liberty film, it could be so much about liberty crumbling, America disintegrating, you know, the urban sprawl around.
It's left up to the viewer,
right? Debased sort of thing, but it's left up to the viewer.
Yeah.
Must be just about, you know, buzzing around the Statue of Liberty. I mean, he's very clever like that. The rigour that Ben talks about, somehow, because it's so rigorously shot, it gives it a chance for all other kinds of meanings to pour in, I think, in a really, really thought-provoking way. So all of us walk away from this with a different kind
with
of
a different
plot line running around.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask, it's a really interesting question. It seems like you're saying that the medium... whatever it is, whether it be painting, whether it be film, and whatever standard of film you're shooting on, whether actually any of the mediums that Steve McQueen or an artist might work on, they aren't the equal of the human experience he's trying to capture. There is an element of that actually the learning of art only goes so far. I'm just trying to capture this thing. These men down a mine doing something which is non-essential. They're not.
Well, I mean, he doesn't say that. I just say that.
I wonder if there is any of that, because often the medium kind of runs out of quality somehow in terms of trying to capture some sort of meaning. Do you know what I mean?
I would say, to a certain degree, it's almost the opposite, okay, in the sense that I feel like this is what I love about Steve McQueen's films, is that you never forget that you're watching a film.
Yeah.
You never forget that the quality of the film, the properties of the film, and yet you never feel like you're in a self-conscious, kind of overly precious investigation of film.
Yeah.
You know, what you have is a kind of intense study of a subject, but using an art medium in its most intense way and really, really drawing the most you possibly can out of it. And I think rather than sort of exposing the limits of media, in a way I feel like he's pushing it so far in each case. You constantly feel like he's finding new things out about
it. You really
this medium.
Get this in the show, because there's so many different filmic experiences. You know, you've got this amazing, one of my favourites in the film, this amazing film, Ashes, about this young, when he was going to shoot Carib's Leap, the one with the falling figures and also the other part projected outside onto the Wall of Tate in Granada, he also filmed this incredibly charismatic, beautiful young man who was a diver. He just filmed on the end of a boat. I think it was because he liked the look of him and thought he looked rather fab, and they became friends. And there he is, Sonny, on the end of the boat. And there's this gorgeous footage on one side of the screen, and then on the other side. So McQueen makes you walk round. You can't see the whole thing at once. You have to literally, it's a two-sided screen. So there you've got this idyllic, this very charismatic guy, a voiceover. So you know things are not going to go well, because the voiceover is a contemporary and a friend talking about his death. But McQueen shot that film and just kept it because he liked the look of it. It was only 11 years later when he went back and discovered that this guy had actually died, because he discovered some drugs that weren't his and got killed by the dealers, basically. So he thought, I must do something in memory of this guy. So you go round the other side, and there you have the sound, which you hear when you're also looking at the sunny, watery side, the sound of Ash's tomb being built. McQueen actually paid for the tomb to be built, and it's a meticulous shooting of the construction of this concrete tomb. So you've got this tremendous memento mori. You are being completely led around. You are being made to go round the other side of the screen. You'll be made to look at two very different sort of film qualities. But you are so captured by this that you don't in any way think, ooh, this is a limited thing, or oh, this is annoying, or I don't want to look on the other side of what's going on. It's so brilliantly orchestrated, but with such deftness. I mean, Ben's quite right about the rigour, that, you know, because he's so rigorous, but it's also lightness of touch. It's like the best line drawing, you know, looks completely effortless. You know, you don't know that you're being told this, but you're absolutely captivated. My concentration threshold in film works that even remotely bore me is zero, you know, and you are absolutely captured in this work.
They're the works themselves, and the fact that, as you say, McQueen makes you go the extra mile, makes you have to investigate things yourself.
Makes you want to go the extra mile.
Makes you want to go
in
the
most
extra
of them,
mile.
Not all of them.
What about the exhibition design at Tate Modern for this particular show? How is it set up? I mean, thinking about that work in particular, although that work is ever thus, I think. I wonder about the Charlotte Rampling one, where they're on old Super 8 projectors. There's something architectural and sculptural about
it's
the way that they're shown.
Absolutely,
right?
Rigorous. I mean, you know, he's down to the catalogue design, everything. I mean, he's absolutely, I mean, he's the only artist I've ever interviewed back in the days of tape recorders, when he wanted me to send in the cassette tape so that he didn't want it being out there with his outtakes on it. You know, I mean, he's absolutely rigorous and controlling about absolutely, this was decades ago, but you know, he's very particular. So it's free form. You know, you walk around, but some of them you have to, like Western Deep, the mine film we were talking about, that has very particular screenings, and you stand outside and you actually see the countdown of the minutes till the screening time. Other works are freestanding, other works you have to go in and look at in special views. But it's not chronological, it's very carefully placed out. You can come in either end, I think, but you know, it's advisable to go in the way that you, the first entrance. And it's a piece of sort of, you know, ambient sculpture kind of in and of itself. There is a sculpture also in it, which to my mind is one of the least successful pieces.
The kind of more traditional work of sculpture.
Which is a bed. It was actually made for Reading Jail, a whole project around Oscar Wilde, and he made the prison bed with a gold mosquito net hanging over it, which just looks completely incongruous. I think you said, Ben, in your review, it looks like another artist's work has been sort of dropped in. I think McQueen, when he makes objects, it's not so successful, myself.
I'm with you on that. And I actually also question, there are two works, and they're really interesting works, but they are very different within McQueen's language, and they are where he uses found material as opposed to shooting the material himself. So one is called Once Upon a Time, and it uses all these images that were sent up to space by NASA and are still in the Voyager spacecraft now, travelling across the universe. And then you have a soundtrack which is speaking in tongues, you know, this sort of indecipherable language. And then you have another piece which is about Paul Robeson and US state surveillance of this major African-American cultural figure. And that is called End Credits, and it is simply a sequence of redacted state memos that were sent in.
You can play
the
redacted drinking game to that one. It's 5 hours long, and every time they say redacted, you just do a shot.
Yeah.
make it out of there alive if you dare.
Right. I mean, and both of these pieces, I thought, yeah, very interesting material. Lots of scope for investigation. I Googled lots after I saw them. But at the same time, I felt there was a sort of separation in the language, which made me pine for the works that aren't in the show. You mentioned that it was after 1999, and I was thinking, you know, we talked about The Body earlier on. I longed to see Bear, that 1993 piece, two wrestling figures, really important piece, his breakthrough work.
Yeah.
And also Deadpan, the work which was famously shown in the Turner Prize, which he won. And I wondered when I was in the show whether actually just a show about the films would have done it, you know, would have made it this an absolute must-see, five-star, you have to see this show. As it is, I think there are these found image works are less successful. They just feel to me to be, in terms of their language, they're just not so effective.
I agree with you about Once Upon a Time, the NASA space probe images, because there's all these sort of slides going on of how we want to project how a certain point of view, an American point of view of a certain era, wanted to project, you know, life on Earth to an alien species, perhaps, and it's all positive and lovely. And you can see, you could possibly say, the rest of the show is a counterbalance to that.
It's kind of like relief compared to some
positive.
Of the works, almost.
But the glossolalia, the talking in tongues, is quite annoying. I agree with that. Actually, I think the end credits, the Robeson piece. I mean, of course it's impossible. You're not going to sit there for 5 hours. You are not going to listen to 42 hours of audio. Also, it's quite annoying because the actual redacted documents go a little bit too fast for you to be able to read. And the voiceover doesn't actually correspond to the documents that you're seeing. And you have to sit down and kind of recalibrate yourself to that. And I find that it was quite annoying. And they're not so instantly, viscerally kind of impactful and engaging as the films. But I thought it was a really, really powerful piece, actually. I love the fact that these documents, these crudely redacted documents of decades of Paul Robeson being surveyed by the FBI
and shown at that size
on that scale was quite extraordinary. And actually it spoke so much about state power, about surveillance, about subjugation, about this poor wretched man going about his everyday business not being subversive just because he happened to have views that were out of kilter with the McCarthyite times. And I thought it was a really powerful piece, and the fact you knew you were never going to see it, it was impossible, and it's still ongoing, I kind of like that, because it's not an easy consumable piece. It is an open-ended artwork that you do kind of sit and go into a reverie about. So I agree with you on the Once Upon a Time, but I actually like that piece, although I did miss the earlier works as well. But I mean, hey, they're going to pop up again in other films, other shows.
We were talking about the difference between sort of found film and the stuff that McQueen's made himself. I interviewed him a couple of years ago. We're going to have a short clip, a couple of minutes, of him talking about, he was promoting a feature film when I spoke to him, obviously the very well-known and equally successful other sort of half of his career, not that he sees it that way. This is Steve McQueen in conversation a couple of years ago.
When you started making films, suddenly, I suppose, a lot of extra jobs, a lot of extra things got added on to making short films with Thomas Dane and your gallery.
I never made short film in my life. I make artworks.
And that's the difference. Do they feel different things when they're in cinemas and they have a different audience expectation attached to them, I wonder?
One is narrative, one is not. Of course, both narrative one way, shape, form, the other, but I would just describe it as one as poetry. Artwork is as poetry, and the feature film is the narrative, the yarn. Both saying different things, but both saying them differently. One is fragmented, fractured, concise, as far as the poetry is concerned, and the yarn is the yarn, the novel is the art and the novel, so they're very different. Using the same devices, but saying things differently.
Do you use a different part of your brain for them?
I don't analyse myself. I don't analyse myself.
I know. I know you get on with things. I know you just do them, or you get on with them.
I just what's true. Again, I think that's the most important thing. My only workings is not my sort of strife, or me striving is all about the truth. That's my main sort of brain function, not sort of how, why, or what. In fact, all those how, why, and what, how, who, why, and what. That's my main brain function. For me, it's just about dealing with, as a person living today, so many things come at you. As a black child, what happens often than not, you become political at a very early age because you are asking those questions very, very early. Mm. How, who, why, and what at a very early stage because of the environment you're in. So it brings a lot of things to the surface.
It's rare for people to have such an august career in two related but always regarded as separate fields as fine art and filmmaking. Mm-hmm. And you're obviously aware of a reputation that you have. Is it something that gives you pleasure? Is it something that you ever think about?
I don't think about it because you're the critic. You think you say that, and it's fine. It's good, nice to hear. But I don't. If I'm not conscious of that, I just do things because I'm an amateur, and I mean that. I'm a very happy British amateur because, as far as I'm concerned, if I become so-called, oh, I think I'm a professional, then I'm done. Nothing for me to learn. Nothing for me to sort of explore. So I'm not at all conscious of that fact in a way. I mean, it's nice to sort of when people get accolades for certain things. Then people sort of he or she is the other. But regardless of that, or you don't get that, or you do get that, it doesn't really matter because I'm on my journey, I'm on my path. I'm trying to sort of work things out through work. I mean, tomorrow, guess what? I might design a men's collection. I don't know. Anyone should be able to do anything they want to do or try to experiment. I've always just tried to sort of to be truthful to who and how I am. That's it. So if it appears like this, well, great, but I'm not conscious of it. I'm not really not focused on that. It's about the work, W-O-R-K, the work, end of story, fact.
It's all about the work. You've seen the films, you've seen the art, now wear the men's collection. That was me getting playfully slapped down by Steve McQueen a couple of years ago.
He is very well dressed.
He is, and he's a really good interview. He was on quite expansive form that day. He's good stuff. I wonder if I can ask you one last question, both. Ben, I wonder if Steve McQueen is kind of an artist hiding in plain sight sometimes. We know very little about him. He's not an artist kind of on the scene like some are. Does this show kind of open up give you the key to a kind of lock in his head, or does it not need to?
It is a very powerful exploration of part of Steve McQueen's life and career. I mean, that's the brilliant thing, isn't it? Yeah. His Tate show offers glimpses of the real greatness of this body of work. And, it has now been 30 years worth of extraordinary work. And, I think it is an essential show, actually, even despite what I just said about not quite being a five-star show. But, I urge people to see it. I think I like the fact that that he's an enigma still as well. And I think that is central to driving
the moments. It's tough to do, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. With every interview, with everything, you kind of chip away at that. I mean, it's, I don't know. What do you think, Louise?
I agree. I mean, he's, I loathe the word mid-career, but, he's got an awful lot of, we hope, many years ahead of him. I mean, when he was an official Iraq War artist, he made a whole set of postage stamps. He surprises you. Whenever he does something that's really great, which is usually, you think, oh, yes, it fits into his work. But you never know what he's going to do. And I think this is a fantastic sort of, a gauntlet being thrown down to wonder what he's going to be doing in the future, but also really admiring what he's done to date. And if there's some great works missing, well, I think there's some great works to come. So that's exciting. It is an essential show, and he's one of our greatest artists, I think.
And so rigorous. You both kind of have mentioned that in all sorts of ways, in all sorts of answers, but there is such a kind of focus, such a sort of toughness about it.
You can tell from the interview that he gave you just then. I mean, he doesn't mess around, and the shot, he chooses his shots really carefully. Uh-huh. He chooses the film stock to do exactly what that film should do. I mean, he really knows there's nothing left. If it's left to chance, it's because he wants it to be left to chance. If a camera's trying to focus on a light source and sort of going backwards and forwards, randomly, it's because he wants it to be doing that randomly. So nothing is left a chance. He's a master, I think, of his craft, and of many others too.
Many artists are really good at the form bit, but fall short on the content bit, or the other way around. With McQueen, you really do have such rigour, not just in the way that they look and the process of their making, but in the acute focus on the subject. That balance of form and content in his work, it's so impressive, I think.
But he won't give you a subtext. He never tells you what the content is. That's the thing. So therefore, the content is there in abundance, but it's for you to extrapolate.
Does that remind you of anyone? because that's what we're doing next. This is where we like to let our listeners into some of the kind of critical tools that you use, or some of the things you take off your bookshelf when you're writing your review. Louisa, what have you chosen?
It's really difficult to make Steve McQueen be like anyone, because he just isn't. He really is. He has influences. You can see certain artists being important to him, you know, Andy Warhol, for example, or whatever. But, you know, he is who he is. But I looked at that. I came out of that show feeling bodily and weird and sort of discombobulated. And I kept thinking Francis Bacon. I kept thinking, I mean, totally different era, different medium, you know.
Physicality.
But it's about the body. It's about, I mean, you know, Steve McQueen doesn't present as queer, but you know, Bacon makes very much queer art. But it's actually not art about, you know, your predilection. It's about sexuality. It's about bodily. Bacon said, I want to make art that works directly on the nervous system. And boy, does Steve McQueen work directly on the nervous system. So I think that sense of looking and feeling and being really there in the kind of the difficulty and the constrained spaces, the boxes, the kind of minimal backgrounds, you know, this whole sense of really kind of grappling. I loathe the word human condition, but, you know, there it is with Bacon, and there it is to a great extent with McQueen. Bacon also loved film and loved photography, and they're very cinematic, I think, his paintings. Also just about what Bacon did with paint, how he made paint do all these weird things. Self-taught, interestingly. I mean, McQueen is not self-taught, but I like the fact he described himself as an amateur, that constant curiosity. And I feel that he has in common with Bacon too, the sense of Bacon trying to always experiment what paint could do, what it could be made to do. Likewise with McQueen, different sorts of film stock, whether it goes all ectoplasmic in that one Illumina where he's just lit up by a television screen and it's his digital camera trying to focus, or whether it's the granular Super 8 with the Western Deep mine. You know, he's always, or the red focus with the Charlotte Rampling eye, so it all goes a bit voyeur and a bit sort of red light district. Mm. I mean, all, you know, this confidence to be able to make film stock be something plastic, aesthetic, but carry all that meaning. And I think Bacon did the same thing with paint. There's kind of ejaculatory spurts, or those really fine veils, the way you things are blurred to imply motion. All these things, flesh, skin, you know, I could bang on. Or tweed. God, he gave good tweed. Bacon, he could really paint a tweed coat. So there you are, there's fashion coming in there as well.
Good tweed.
But, you know, there is that sense very much. I think, you know, they're totally different artists, different eras, different everything, but I do see some commonalities there.
So Francis Bacon. Ben, what have you chosen?
I'd chosen Tricky. It was odd because I don't necessarily think it was the best film in the show, yet it was the film I went away thinking about constantly. It was so
mesmerising. It's really haunting, isn't it?
Yeah, haunting and mesmerising, and also almost hallucinatory, even though it was so documentary. You know, again, McQueen's brilliant at these dualistic qualities that he has. But yes, and it prompted me to go back and listen to Maxine Kay, that great album from 1995, which of course made in a similar period to when McQueen was finding his language, you know. And what an album, my word, what an album. I mean, it is, you know, that I was a student in 1995, and it was a sort of documentary soundtrack to our lives, so many of us in that period. And you think about that period in Bristol and Portishead, their album Dummy the year before, and of course Massive Attack, who Tricky was once a member of. And what an extraordinary, fertile and dark and wonderful period for British music.
Yeah, it's something that was never, it wasn't trying to be like anything that came before.
I remember going and seeing Tricky. I'm a bit older than Ben. I saw at the Royal Festival Hall. He'd gone a bit more main or South Bank. It was on the South Bank anyway, and it was that Maxine Kay's album. It was that time. And I mean, he was mesmerising. I was quite far back, and it wasn't sort of mosh pity at all. It was all rather respectable in the seats. But I mean, he absolutely held it. And that voice and the way that he sings, and he was having great big tokes in McQueen's film, and indeed also during the concert that I saw. But you do feel like you're getting kind of stoned watching him and with him, and he takes you into very strange places with that voice. I think that film being so deadpan was so brilliant, McQueen's film, because he didn't need it. Tricky gave it all to you anyway.
Beautifully said. That was Tricky's first album, which was called Maxine Kay 1995. Everyone will be putting it on at home now. I put it on when I got home from this exhibition as well. And Louisa chose the work of Francis Bacon. Thank you both very much indeed for such expert insights into this Steve McQueen show, which is on at the Tate Modern in London until May the 11th. Thanks again to my guests today, Louisa Buck and Ben Luke. We'll be back at the same time next week. Thank you very much for tuning in.